Welcome, everyone, to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. We have two excellent writers today. We have Kate Kimball and Jamie Ringleb. Before we get started hearing from them, we have a few reminders for you.
So please don't smoke. Don't forget to turn your phone off. And if you can, refrain from getting up during the reading. Up first, to introduce Kate Kimball, is Sakina Hoffler.
When Kate first asked me to introduce her in early August, I said, "Of course, Kate, I'd love to." When Kate emailed me on August 26th, re-asking me to introduce her, I said, "Of course, Kate, I'd love to." When Kate emailed me again on September 21st to make sure I was still introducing her, I said, "Of course, Kate." What I should have said the first time Kate asked me was, "Of course, Kate, I've been waiting 3 years to introduce you." There are two major equal reasons why I've always wanted to introduce Kate: her wonderful writing and her resilience. Kate and I entered FSU in 2013, she a first-year PhD in fiction, and me a first-year MFA in fiction. We often crossed paths. We took Mark's fiction workshop together. She was the online editor, and I was the assistant online editor for the Southeast Review, and our hours overlapped at the Reading and Writing Center. During the spring semester, I noticed a change in Kate's appearance. Specifically, her hair started getting shorter and shorter until one day I saw her and she was bald. I'd be afraid to ask, but I would ask her, "How are you doing?" And she always smiled and say, "I'm fine, I'm okay." I later learned that Kate was sick, very sick. What shocked me though wasn't her illness, but her stubborn determination to keep going. While mostly everyone else in the situation might have had a breakdown and taken a sabbatical from school, Kate maintained a full course load, taught, worked in the Reading and Writing Center, maintained a second secret job, later picked up a third job, kept working at SCR, drove to both Jacksonville and Orlando on a regular basis to receive treatment, hosted a warehouse reading series every Tuesday, and kept on writing and writing, all without asking for help. Let that sink in. It got to the point that when I thought I was tired or overwhelmed, I would think of Kate and ask myself, "What the hell is your excuse, Sakina?" Kate, the epitome of badassness, became my role model for how to persevere. The other reason I'm proud to be here is because of Kate's writing. Her characters are often tortured by worldly affairs or their own internal struggles. She often uses her home state, Utah, as a backdrop. But similarly to how Kate has traveled the country and the world, so too have some of her characters. We've had three workshops together, and I found a critique I wrote 2 years ago for her short story collection, You Are Here. The opening says, "Hi, Kate. Thank you for allowing us into your world. I struggled with religion for a while, which makes your collection all the more refreshing and very, very helpful. You are not averting your eyes at all in any of these stories, and that matter-of-fact realness makes each story visceral." Kate is not only visceral in her writing about religion, specifically Mormonism and faith. Her themes often circle around body image, self-harm, family, friendship, sexual assault, and identity. Whether her characters are dealing with mundane or elevated circumstances, you never doubt her ability to tell a story. Instead, you allow yourself to get swept up in these worlds of clashing families, moral questioning, and abuse. If I had to boil Kate's writing down to one word, that word would be raw. Like a claw digging into your chest, tearing your heart out, then squeezing your heart until it bursts and blood leaks down the claw type raw. Kate Kimball is a fiction PhD student at Florida State University. She received her MFA from Virginia Tech. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming in Hunger Mountain, Arcadia, The Chaffee Review, The Hawaii Review, Kestrel and a Capra Review, among others. Her collection of short stories, You Are Here, was longlisted for publication by Stillhouse Press, and her novel, Blueprint She Left Me, was a semifinalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award in 2011. Having worked over 50 jobs, and being from Salt Lake City, Utah, has given her ample material to draw from. Currently, she's at work on her novel, The Misbegotten Sisterhood. Kate, thank you after 3 years for letting me introduce you. I'm very excited to call you to the stage. All right.
Uh, that was so nice. Thank you, Sakina. And thanks to Matt and Whitney for hosting The Warehouse. And for everyone for coming out. I even had a friend fly out here from Salt Lake City to hear my reading. So really, really excited. I hope this is my last reading. I'm trying to graduate in the spring, so you never know, but hopefully this is it. So when I was thinking about what to read, I decided I wanted to read something that deals with all of my obsessions, of which there are many, and something that kind of goes with the raw content that Sakina mentioned. So I decided the most fitting theme for me to read would be the beginning of my novel. You don't really need to know any background information about this piece, except that it does deal with missionaries from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Mormon missionaries. And a little bit about missionary work, you know, people don't have to go on missions, but they choose to go. They're a lot like our undergraduate students, who are some of who are here tonight, who are like 18 or 19 years old. They put in papers and they are called to go anywhere in the world. Okay, so sometimes you get really awesome callings like Hawaii or England, and sometimes you're like me and you go to West Virginia, right? So, hey, West Virginia was great. But so it kind of deals with the missionary thing. The title of my novel is The Misbegotten Sisterhood, and this is part one, Cape Town, South Africa, 2005, before. At first, we thought it was baboons. We would remember the glass smashing and the sound of the wind that woke us. We heard the creak of the floorboards, the bang of the flimsy front door of our isolated bungalow, hidden behind a series of locked gates. And for a second, as I squinted, I could see a sliver of light that I could have sworn was coming from the refrigerator. We heard the rustle of and the crash of glass, and Sister Paige, sleeping on the bed adjacent to mine, slowly reached across the gap, looking for me, her sharp whispers of my name, her hands patting my arms. I curled tighter inside the blankets, but listened to the thump of the steps, the beat of my heart, and the way that I wished for my older sister, Ray. She was the only one capable of stopping everything. She was the most dangerous person I knew. At first, we smelled them. They were musky and foreign, something primal. We felt the weight of them as they leaned over us, whispering sharply for us not to move, not even a little, and then we wished they were baboons, anything other than what they were. Don't open your eyes. Don't scream. Don't breathe. We felt them caress our faces as though they were our lovers. They kissed our cheeks, lips, necks. You need me, one said. You've been waiting. I wondered who he was, searching my mind for images of dark men's faces. I was unable to decipher anything. I heard the faraway sound of the train, the wind of the ocean as it blew fiercely against the walls of our bungalow in Cape Town, a new place of residence I had moved into after arriving from the Missionary Training Center in Provo, Utah, 4 weeks ago. Sister Paige had been out for 9 months, and she had dealt with baboons before. They crawled through the windows, searching for food in the cupboards, eating whatever they could find out of the refrigerator. They tore through loaves of bread and ate blocks of cheese, swallowed bananas whole. They were a complete nuisance, and they made an utter mess. You couldn't fight them. You had to give in no matter what. Don't make any sudden movements. Don't try to resist, because they'd bite you viciously. Can we give you money? Sister Paige whispered. Can you leave? We don't want your white money. We don't want to leave. I felt my legs harden against the mattress and I curled tighter, feeling the hands reach for me. I could offer everything, the entire sum of $800 that I had in my savings account, and I knew that would not be enough. Even though I had not been in South Africa long, I had grown used to the way everyone thought white people had money, that Americans were vending machines, stolen ATMs. At home, I had nothing, but out here, that nothing was everything. Sister Paige and I would debate the day after about how many there were. She saw them as an army or a mid-sized platoon, maybe 10 or 20. I counted 3 or 4. I felt the thin fingers of a hand as it poked and prodded me. I felt calloused skin and the crooked nails as they dug deep into my skin. One large finger prodded my eyes, pushed on them. "You can't touch us," Sister Page said. "We are missionaries of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." We heard them laugh and exchange clicks, a slur of words in heavy Xhosa. The click of an argument circled around the room, and I squinted again, trying to make out the alarm clock on the nightstand, 3:32. We would find that baboons didn't forage for food at night. They huddled together and rested. They would show up in the early mornings or late afternoons. "Please," I said, "keep your eyes closed. Don't move." Their breath smelled like rotting meat and cigarette smoke and alcohol, and they breathed heavily, moving my limbs around, opening me to the freezing cold air. "Cooperate." Xhosa roared between them, laughter and clicks and sharp syllables that sounded like garbled whispers. It was almost beautiful. Sister Paige started to pray, her words loudly going over the Xhosa. "Please, Father in heaven, please protect us. Please make these men go away." I couldn't open my mouth or eyes. I froze and prayed to disappear, to float gently away from my body, above my head, over the rafters, outside towards the wind. I felt the fingerprints pressing into my arms, the pull of my garments, the sacred underwear I was promised would protect me when I became an endowed temple-worthy member prior to my missionary service. This isn't happening to me. This isn't happening to my body. I felt the sticky fingerprints along my breast, along my belly. The hands pounded into me as though I was pizza dough being rolled out, tossed, turned for dinner. "Please make these men leave and please protect us. We are your servants. We are your servants." "Please," I said, "you're hurting me. Cooperate. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your eyes shut. If you cooperate, you'll be okay. Do you understand?" "Yes. Yes. I promise." Maybe there were 10 or 20, but it felt more like only a few. Maybe they were older and skilled, guerrilla warfare warriors angered by years of apartheid and foreign ignorance and passivity. But then they seemed younger, maybe even younger than us, and they spoke to each other, chanting in Xhosa, begging each other on. Sister Paige screamed, and I heard the smack of her flesh and felt it as though it was my own face that had been hit. I felt her fingertips graze my arm. "Cooperate." I felt the men's hands grip my legs, but they weren't my legs. I floated out, hovering the clock of Xhosa, covering my ears, stuffing the tubes, muffling the sound. I couldn't breathe, and I gasped when the cool air touched my skin. My garments lifted up, tearing the point of a knife below my navel, the hand crawling between my legs. "Open." I clenched my eyes tighter, feeling the men pull my legs apart, the pressure of one sliding deep inside of me, rocking, sweating, screaming. His body was hot, almost burning me, and I felt the slither of sweat between his skin and mine. There was the burn, the thick pain between my legs, chafing. The Xhosa clouded my ears. My head pounded. My heart thumped. I called for Ray. "No one is here. No one can save you." I felt Sister Paige's hand flutter close to me, and I gripped her fingers, closing for warmth. Outside, I strained to hear the ocean. It was one of those details I had romanticized in my letters home to my mother. "We are by the coast. We can hear the ocean. Its roar a comfort, but not a savior." I felt the warmth of Sister Paige's close but distant hand. "Cooperate." I felt the liquid between my legs, felt the throb of my center. I sucked in my breath, slow, the air suffocating me. "Be still, my soul." Doctrine and Covenants, section 6, verse 33. "Fear not to do good, my sons, for whatsoever ye sow, that shall ye also reap." My sons. Ray would ask, where were the daughters? Ray would say there had never was any consideration for the daughters. They are heavy, and I can feel one's heart pump towards mine. He bites my collarbone, gripping my neck, whispering. I float again, reciting DNC section 6, the verse I am supposed to recite from memory in district meeting later that week. Sister Paige cries even when they tell her to stop. "Go away," she pleads. "Please don't do this. How will I face my savior? It's cold and then hot. I smell the cigarette smell and hear the flick of a lighter. The smoke is pungent, and for a second, I think I will vomit. I can't breathe. The hand on my throat pushes down, and I cough before I am hit, my face throbbing. Keep your mouth shut. Keep your eyes shut. Cooperate. You don't want to die. For a second, I hover again and think about how this will be the moment I will always remember, the day I lost my virginity, the day men broke into our temporary mission home and stole everything and threatened us, the day my garments didn't protect me, but then maybe they did, the day I heard Kosa sound more beautiful and promising than any hymn Sister Paige and I had ever sung. I felt my heart throbbing and felt the man pull out, sweating, pushing down on my shoulders. Did you like that? In the Provo Missionary Training Center, I had learned about Joseph Smith and all of the trials he went through. He was beaten and tarred and feathered. He had children killed. He ended up being murdered. There was something to that, wasn't there? It had meaning and purpose. We were always training to be martyrs. Did you? I don't feel who else enters me, but there is more than one, and I lose count, trying to make sense of a language that I can't translate. It is my greatest fear. It is the worst thing that can happen. Sister Paige is crying, and other than that, I hear nothing, not any of the usual nighttime sounds. I will stay still for what feels like hours, feeling the throb of my insides, and when I begin to move, opening my eyes to the haze of light, when the men are long gone, I will see that it's almost 6:30 and that it's time to get up. Sister Paige and I won't get up, though. We will sleep and sleep and sleep. And when we get up, it will be 4:27, and we will realize that we have broken the mission rules. Thank you.
Okay, our next person on the stage is going to introduce our next reader, a poet, and that person is Dorothy Chan. Please give her a round of applause.
Hello. So when I think of Jamie Ringlab, who's sitting right there, yeah, I think of all his alter egos. First of all, there's Ringleby, which is his Instagram handle, a cross between a ringlet and a bee, who's photographed in a lot of aprons and looks fine in them. There's Leonardo from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, aka, in Jamie's words, the anal retentive leader who dresses in blue. And I mean, that's really important because which Ninja Turtle you are is a very, very important question of life. You can like learn a lot about someone from that, you know? And I just have to emphasize that with that question, Jamie has answered correctly. And then poetically, maybe he's the male form of Sylvia Plath minus the tragedy, maybe. And this description is now super fitting considering that in the past week, people have been describing themselves in like three fictional characters all over social media. Anyway, this is Jamie, but on a really shallow level. Jamie likes things organized. He is exacting and precise and reliable. He's articulate. He's classic with a twist. This translates into his poetry. But while Jamie is all of these things, I believe that heart is the most important quality in his writing. Whether it's a love poem against the body, a haibun sequence about his father, or an ironic poem about his mother. He deals with sentimentality in a non-sickening way by challenging the traditional notions and conventions of the love poem, which is his specialty. His love poems are filled with lines that are 11 syllables rather than 10, 13 lines rather than 14, and he titles them XO rather than ending them with XO, as in a traditional love letter, but different. And of course, they're all a little weird. And a little weird is good. Jamie is the expert of the love poem. And Jamie's poems are filled with a lot of heart. Jamie Ringlab grew up in upstate South Carolina in northern Italy. He holds an MFA from the University of Oregon and is currently a PhD student in poetry here at FSU. Jamie is the recipient of scholarships at the Sewanee Writers Conference and the Lambda Literary Writers Retreat, a Fish Trap Fellowship, and prizes from the University of Oregon. His poems have appeared or are forthcoming in The Journal, Adroit, and Nimrod. Great list of publications. So, Jamie Ringleb.
Hello, hi. Why not say it twice? It went closer like this. Hello, hi. all right, I'd like to thank Matt and Whitney for hosting, Matt for the alligator tooth, which I'm hoping will serve me well tonight, Keith for putting this all together, FSU, of course, and of course also the warehouse. I'm just going to jump into it because I'm nervous and bad at idle chatter. Love poem against the body. This man I'm seeing thinks his nipples are baby grape-shaped and pale as two sun-faded pencil top erasers, and he doesn't like when I question or bite them. Our first date, we split pork nachos until I saw his fingertips were flaked with dead skin. He sucks on them. He sucks on all of them, all at once, and a little crankily, like a toddler demolishing a corn cob. He has blood that thickens as if he's sick, and special machines and hypertension meds he sucks down. This man asks, inspecting my nipples with a dying thumbprint, what about yourself do you hate most? The blood, brain, eyeballs, bowels. We sleep in a snarl, like lovers found in snow. There is so much that will be done to us, and we have nowhere else to go. Well, thanks, guys, thanks. This next poem is called A Little Learning. There are points where it's in someone else's voice, which I hope I make clear. If you're like, that's weird, then pretend somebody else said it. A Little Learning. Eddie used to touch her men like this. Deep down, she said. We all wanted what she had, all the evidence she'd collected on love between bodies. Many would have paid for it and believed anything. A real man keeps his pocket watch in the folds of the heart. Anything that opens is a mouth. Any mouth will swallow you up. Even now, I still believe that to make a person love you, you just have to do the trick right. In a certain order, maybe, with a clap of the hands or some sort of hocus pocus, and his mouth will open to you over and over, like a cupboard. Prick yourself on a spindle, you'll die with no one. Prick yourself on a compass, they'll come to you in droves. Eddie loved the one who came to her in 11th grade, moved downriver with a herd of fainting goats to the deep country where the galaxy's arms cast their pollen across the barely visible Blue Ridge, black hills darkened by black pines, black sky. Goat liver keeps the devil off your heart, she told me. Stooped by the rec center bleachers we'd snuck to after her husband's funeral to smoke. Tobacco takes down a swelling if you have one, she said. And then a cup of vinegar under our bed meant we never did get in the family way. I haven't seen Eddie. Coming home holidays, I take the county highway, a narrow road north next to a stretch of river that brings me up between 6 Mile and Nuri. I keep an eye for goats, but never really find any, just corn stalk stubble and cracked soil and power lines crooning their work songs into nothing. Those drives, any figure I see is Eddie. Any story is true. Anything that opens is a mouth. A fox means a rainstorm. An owl means a death. A deer means, I wasn't looking hard enough. The man who fell in love with the moon. In the hours before Lewiston, Driving the gorge on the slower Washington side, I listened to the Odyssey on tape. Telemachus has borrowed his own black boat, the murderous suitors in pursuit. Wheat hills in the gorge looked like clumped sand dunes, miles-long tracks crossing them all as though war tanks had torn through. I always want to see the landscape as invaded, how Mars becomes suddenly visible even in light, or in the gorge, light itself casting wind turbine shadows across sage mountains like fingers trying to steal the sage without profit. Odysseus is in Ogygia. Ogygia. What a stupid little word. As is Ringleb, which sounds like a persistent foot infection. And my father, I try to imagine white sand, a coastal cottage in the west of Sicily, a wife picking wild rocket he's planted in the lawn. In evenings, he brings fresh urchins in a small black mesh bag he carries with him always to the sea, and she cleans the urchins of white sand, and together they cook. Quietly, because they are so in love. Tonight, I bought 2 bottles of Cook's from the only Safeway in Lewiston. And now, filling gluey plastic sacks with machine ice, I work to cool them quickly in a motel mini fridge, which won't close without my duffel propped against it. And while I wait, I watch an old video of Alan Shepard hitting golf balls on the moon. Golf balls that would have flown for miles, maybe, before landing in white sand, grains of which, for a short time, may have floated, then suspended like little orbitless planets. It is a stupid thing to say my father enjoys golfing, but maybe he does. Maybe he is sad or in love. Maybe he is lonelier than all those stupid little golf balls on the moon. Thank you. This next one is called Mutius in the Garden of Rejection. Mutius is a character from Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus who is killed by his father for an act of treason. That act of treason is defending Mutius's brother and his lover so that they can continue to be in love. It also mentions a lyrebird, which is a particular type of, I believe, Australian bird that can kind of remarkably and perfectly mimic almost any noise that it hears. So, Mutius in the Garden of Rejection. There are 5 biblical gardens of significance, but more than 25 gardens of significance in Rome, buried under other gardens of significance in Rome. The biblical gardens of significance have not been buried, but God has closed some of them. There are no lyrebirds in Rome, but if there were, they would roost mostly in the Vatican's English garden and mimic the fountain of the eagle's fixed hiss. Lyrebirds are doltish songsters who, closed in a fox's mouth, go limp even before the scrap is done. Here are the major facts. Lyrebirds must roost in low branches, unable as they are, like chickens, to fly for very long. And Mutius is given 25 words before his father casually kills him with a sword. Meanwhile, the Cantonese slang 25 boy means traitor, a small coincidence. Another, in my country, 2.5 is the percent of killings that are filicides. 3 of Mutius's last 25 words are the word help, as are 2 of his last 3. The 5 significant gardens of the Bible are the garden of rebellion, the garden of rejection, the garden of redemption, the garden of reception, and the garden of rejoicing. So many wreaths, as though the Bible keeps trying to get gardens right. 25, in biblical terms, signifies grace multiplied by grace, grace upon grace, which to some Christians means God calls back his children by killing 100% of them. Beside the temple in the Villa Borghese gardens, I bend down to dig. The uncovered soil smells like burnt olives, and I wield a toy spade with the other tourists, revealing a fake archaeological site, buried gardens of the real Lucius Licinius Lucullus, who has, we're told, been memorialized by a strain of Swiss chard, a mild and sweet strain, one which holds well after cutting. In my edition of Titus Andronicus, the stage direction is stabbing Mutius. But my edition of Titus Andronicus does not specify the number of times Mutius is stabbed. My father knows why 5 is the biblical number for grace, and he knows how to multiply grace by grace, but I do not. I dig in the foreign garden where I want a lyrebird to be, and a fox who knows the lyrebird can fly, but not for long. And that it can live for 25 years, but rarely does. This next one is called Peacock at a Garden Party. All the little fiats have clambered up the hill on the old Roman road, reformed, it translates, and in shallow ditches lining the villa have parked nose first. Their owners, skinny suited Slovenes and Italian Northern Leaguers, orange cheeked and already in their wine, go slipping up the hill. I am in my father's garden, holding a tray of undercooked, clean cut pigeon breasts skewered top to bottom. It's talk of the wild peacock none of us has seen. It cries like a child from the bordering thicket while I make new rounds with a tray of potato dumplings, little mouthfuls, the yellow dumpling like an allergic eye, flushing with clusters of meat, the bitter green, a pink one lidded and sweet. I am in my father's garden, in a silk-lined suit and a thin European tie, watching two little boys, Umberto and Lorenzo, I think they are called, dig a limb of charcoal from the outlying grill. Umberto drags black lines beneath Lorenzo's eyes, arms himself with a stick, and both boys disappear down the hill, our wailing peacock quiets and hides. I am in my father's garden, where a south wind runs off with the sun. My father ruffles my thick dago hair. Here we are. Love, it seems, is a lack of alternatives. The pride and joy cottonwoods, flaring hierarchies of branches flap their papery leaves. Underneath a juniper hedge, the peacock folds and flattens its plumage of bored, bright eyes and holds its breath. Thanks, guys. That would have been sweet. I just have a couple more poems left. The first one is called Self-Portrait as Medusa in Shock. You'll notice me say Medusa and then also Medusa. Medusa is an Italian word that's explained in the first line, so that's why I'm talking funny. Self-Portrait as Medusa in Shock. Medusa being the Italian word for, of all things, jellyfish. Precious, fleshy poison sacks, the sea's white spit, as if Perseus had released a severed head back into the water, and the head had burst, metamorphosed like a kind of Christian remorse, into a swarm of these upside-down, dunce-faced nothings. Dotted and rootless sea trees, the gods' hungriest, most unloved children. And though I never loved the stories, we're turning a mirror on a thing, cured it of itself. I did love the stories of delivery and return, Jonah cracked from the whale's skull, or Jesus cracked from the cave, and Lazarus cracked, and the prodigal cracked, racked with guilt, and even Eve like Medusa, if only in a mirror shield cracked, and from her neck, from the interior, spilled a golden giant and a winged horse, imagine that, all in an impossible shock. I like to think of color, impossibility being any God's word for, of all things, love, not other precious fleshy poison. When I allow myself in stories to return to some point of origin, the way souls drag with them their finite bodily sadnesses if they return to heaven. The stories seem to always recount the returns I have made to my own father. In my versions of heaven, my father's rented boat off the coast in the Sicilian north, say, I struggle always to climb aboard. And in that struggle, am kissed above the right elbow by a Medusa. And my father, outraged by this offense, and though he can afford to be stung by nothing, though a bee or red ant or jellyfish would stop his heart, arms himself with, of all things, his wife's snorkel gear, and for a half hour circles the boat to snatch up, in a little net you might use to scoop dead goldfish from their bowls, all the jellyfish he can find, turning them out to slowly die on the spackled deck next to the boat's ladder. A father can work to keep his children from all the world's injuries, save his own. The way in anaphylaxis, when a sting felt again is tremendous enough, even the body's healing turns an accidental mirror on itself and irreparably cracks. This, in the stories of seeing the self, is the shock that makes any return to it impossible. From the interior, a healing so great, it petrifies the heart for good. Thank you. You guys have been really, really sweet. This is my last poem. It's called Love Poem. Imagine a day alone and call it love. Let it mean all things are equal. Let it mean you have eaten, you are filled on a randomness of quick sale meats. Use the word delicious. For yourself, use the word collected, complete. Let it mean all things revolve around a wet living stone. Call it heart. Let it mean the earth moves with you, loop after loop. Never mind what you are known for, or last night's dinner of cheese bread. What is sadness? Think sadness was a friend across the table. Never mind the man she wanted to name for you over dinner on Friday. What was his name? Anthony? Never mind Anthony. Anthony is blonde and blue-eyed and a waiter, and it said quite funny. Think Anthony is not a day alone, though. Not love. Let this break your heart. But don't say break your heart here or anywhere. Nobody wants to see it wild and out. In this poem, ask what heart? Let it be the wet living stone. Revolve around it this way, alone and alive. Remember, you are equal to anything, equal to the earth. Say, little heart, for all your murmuring, I imagine you're textured like a persimmon. Say, little heart, if you are at all like a persimmon, I'll seal you in a jar of lime water to rid you of your unbearable flavor. Say, little heart, which of your ventricles is your favorite, your hardest worker? Say, little heart, I've tested the idea, you're my hardest worker and will not stop. Drop your little heart in a mason jar and set it aside for the day. You'll be truly in love then, won't you? You will be complete. This poem won't mind what you are known for or what you have brought with you. Nobody will love you like this poem does. Let this poem fill you. Let it wash your hair. It will use egg whites and honey. Maybe you'd like something different. Tell this poem what you want. Anything. The earth. Say, little heart, let me thumb you through until all your stones are turned and your meats sold. Say, little heart, let there be a primacy in you. Let there be a primacy in you a poem can get to. Thank you.
Thank you guys for coming. Be sure to take your glasses or your bottles back to the bar. Thank you.
And please join us next week when we'll hear from Eric Schlick and Etkin Kamungu.